Brother Diallo Show, episode 15. I'm so happy to be with you here this morning, despite my technical difficulties. Let me see. Headphones check. Having some issues with the mic, but what can we do? Let's see. Give me one moment. Sorry. Greetings again. Okay, I fixed the levels on the mic. The headphones are still a little janky, but that's underground radio. Like I said, I don't know. Maybe NSA agents come in here and tamper and twist buttons and poke buttons. No, twist knobs and poke buttons, because every time I come in here, there's a new technical challenge. But anyway, we overcome morning after morning, episode after episode, rant after rant, interview after interview. The Bro Diallo Show is going to keep it moving. I actually was here Monday. I showed up and the whole place was locked down for Labor Day, which to me, Labor Day is now synonymous with the West Indian Day Parade, Eastern Parkway, Brooklyn, New York, where I observed my first West Indian carnival in Babylon. So I don't know if it's legit. I mean, for the West Indian community in the U.S. is definitely legit, but I've never been to a Caribbean carnival or a South American carnival, but next best thing, I suppose, Eastern Parkway. I lived right on the Eastern Parkway, so I could literally, you know, just walk out the front door and into the Labor Day. And then, you know, I made some West Indian friends, so I started going to the whole Pasa Pasa and all that. It's like, wow, it's pretty impressive. Pretty intensive, like professional partying. We don't know get down like that. Where I come from in the Midwest, a carnival means Ferris wheels and trying to throw little plastic rings around ducks' necks to get really cheap, toxic plastic stuffed animals. But West Indians do it a whole nother way. Anyway, shout out to the Yardies, Trini, and Guyana, which is the English-speaking nation in South America that, you know, kind of caucuses with the West Indies. Shout out to Guyana, Guyanese, Bajan. I shouldn't even attempt to do this because I know I'm going to miss somebody, have somebody call and curse me out. Virgin Islands. Trini, did I say Trini? Trinidad, Tobago, all of the diasporan Africans that reside in the Caribbean, in South America. And I think Panama represents, I don't know the classifications. It's like Central America, South America, Caribbean. And I see every year I would see a stronger presence of the red, black, and green for blacks born in the United States, Africans in America. Africans born in America, shout out to ABI Nation. So, you know, it's kind of like evolving or developing into a pan-African type feel, because all black folks, you know, wave their respective colonial flags and represent their islands that they traded for continents or continent. But I'm glad you guys have fun. Sorry to hear about the violence that often is associated with both, not just the carnival, but with Labor Day. Chicago, we had, 13 homicides over the Labor Day weekend. We're on our way to record numbers of homicides throughout the city. Again, we spoke of that. I mean, we touched on that in the last show, dealing with individuals calling for the National Guards. One thing we have to accept about violence in the black community, what I call not black-on-black violence, but lateral violence, compounding oppression, provokes such violence, is that this violence is not just tied to, but it's integral to the larger economic system. So if you're stopping the violence without changing the larger economic systems, you're not in creating peace, you're engaging in pacification. You want people to suffer and be under-resourced and degraded without lashing out. So as the violence we understand, we who look beyond the surface, is a byproduct of larger historical and economic injustices, if you're not addressing the larger history, you're not addressing the larger status quo and conditions, then you're pacifying. And if that's what you want to go for, I'm not going to condemn people out here organizing for pacification. I just don't want them calling what they do peace work, or struggling for peace, or striving for peace, or advocating for peace. I only ask that you accurately identify your efforts. What you're doing is pacification of the black population. And if your value system, your ideology, your methodology, or you are a larger social justice person, but you think that the violence is so immediate, that it's such a horrendous issue, that you're willing to bypass the long-term struggle, the long-term solutions for more immediate responses, reaction, then I'm not going to judge you. There's other things you could be doing with your time than advocating for pacification. But just properly identify what you're doing. Just admit to what you're doing. So if you're not struggling against capitalism, if you're not struggling against and this pretty much relates to anywhere you find black population centers, but mainly Chicago, if you're not struggling against the one-party oligarchy, the intensely corrupt, the blatantly naked corruption of Chicago politics, and not just Chicago politics, but Chicago black leadership. In your organization, in your mosque, in your church, in your civic organization, in your community development corporation, in your college or university, in any formation, all of them are corrupt and dysfunctional. And if you're not fighting against all of that, if you're not fighting for socialist communal economic distribution of the resources and wealth, then you are struggling for pacification. Not justice, not liberation, and definitely not peace. Because, and then on top of that, more people, as horrendous as the homicides in the black community on the south side of Chicago are, it's between a 6-to-1 to 10-to-1 ratio that your life can be prematurely ended, or your body, without any type of congenital or inborn maladies, your body can be crippled, or your life can be prematurely ended by your diet. Heart disease, cancer, kidney failure is a more aggressive blight, is at epidemic levels in our communities. So if it is about Black Lives Matter, or if you're simply classifying the lives ended by violence, by gun violence, as opposed to the lives prematurely ended by toxic food, substandard or non-existent health care, then again, you are organizing for pacification. And pacification simply means you endure all of the injustices, oppression, and dehumanization without lashing out. You know, so you got three things. Number one, peace is when you target the root causes of violence, when you fundamentally change the economic system, you fundamentally change the methods of delivering services and resources to the people. You fundamentally change the people's relationship with the state government. You fundamentally change the structure and leadership of black organizations or institutions that touch the lives of black people. When you change those, when you inject justice into those bodies, you will automatically have a reduction in lateral violence. When you begin to organize against and subvert descending violence, which is violence coming from the elites, violence coming from the government, violence coming from the military, and not just cops shooting us. The fact that the United States invest over, what is it up to now, 60% of the budget in military, and that's direct military, and that doesn't even deal with all the peripheral military-industrial complex. If you're not organizing, you can't say peace in the hood while ignoring or even advocating and supporting violence across the globe. And it's and just holding a gun to someone's head is considered a violent act, whether you pull the trigger or not. The threat of violence is classified as an assault. If I threaten to do violence, or if I give someone the impression that I'm willing to or intend to do violence to them, that's also assault. So the United States literally has a gun to the planet's head with having the largest military and the largest military budget in human history. And that's in real numbers and in relative numbers. If you are not organizing against all that, so if you deal with all of that, if you begin to target that, even the very process of addressing that will bring about peace. The very process of addressing that will bring about peace. So that's bringing about peace. And that's it. There's no shortcut to peace. It's something that takes a long time to build from where we stand now. It will take a relatively long time. But the more people we can get to understand this and engage in these actions, then the quicker we can get there. But then you have the other alternative, which is you bypass all of the elite, high-level, institutional status quo stuff, and you go directly to those victims. And both the murderers and the murder victims are both victims. They're both have been subjected to systematic oppression, exploitation, dehumanization, anti-African, intensive, global, worldwide anti-African propaganda. So if you go directly to them and say, hey, you two, despite all this stuff coming down on you, the shooter and the shootee, you stop shooting at each other. Because we black, whatever rationale you get them, don't shoot them because they're black, don't shoot them because it's not right, don't shoot them because you'll injure, whatever reason, you're engaged in pacification. But then there's a third option, which is you can revolutionize the violence, which means you don't struggle for peace or pacification, you simply redirect the violence, which is what happened in Palestine, in Vietnam, where people had a lot of oppressed, angry, and charged individuals. That's what the Black Liberation Army in the 60s attempted to do in the 70s. Not to end violence, but simply redirect the violence. You know, raise your guns for, instead of for personal gains and personal vendettas, it's for collective gain and collective vendettas. And that's the riskier one. So the first option, peace, is the long haul, which will provoke the elites and those at the top of the food chain, top of the hierarchy, at the top of the capitalist pyramid of skulls. They will do violence to you. Martin Luther King, to quote Wise Intelligent, Martin taught me much when he simply tried to love him, brother, all about peace, and the devils had to snuff him. So if you're working for real peace, because Martin Luther King was initially working for pacification, nonviolence, because they both, which we overlooked, they had a societal agenda, which was integration and equality, but there were also internal agendas. But if you're working for real peace, Martin Luther King said, hey, I'm going to deal with the larger society. You notice Martin Luther King didn't walk around talking about black folks ain't this and black folks, what black folks need to do, blah, 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 like a lot of our black leaders condemning us as if, like Bill Cosby's argument was, if we spoke standard English, pulled our pants up and read more books, then by default, just that alone will cause an end to racism and a reduction to racism, at least, and an end to oppression and a miraculous development of black empowerment. You know, which it has no historical, but hey, Bill Cosby, Dr. Bill Cosby, what did he get his degree in? Physical education. And his doctor was honorary doctorate for making us laugh and entertaining us so thoroughly over the years. So take what Dr. Bill Cosby said with a grain of salt. But nobody's listening to him now. He's been disgraced. Dr. King, back to my point. Let's come out. Don't get me started on the good doctor. Your daddy, Huxtable. Dr. King was about peace. And so even if you go the peace route, then you could still expect violence, but not from your own people. Violence will come, descend on you from the elites, because peace is a threat. The problem with peace is peace is inversely proportional to profit. When you look at the massive conflicts to the elites, not the society, but again, which I'll repeat this so often, in a capitalist economy, the health of the economy has no direct correlation to the health of the society, which means you can have a very healthy capitalist economy with a very impoverished society, very dysfunctional society. In fact, GDP growth often inflates when there's a disaster, when there's conflict, when there's great insecurity. You know, capital tends to expand in the society. People are more willing to invest. Like whenever you hear about a natural disaster, the floods in Louisiana, the fires on the coast, on the West Coast, the BP oil spills, and the media will say, "Oh, these disasters," and the war in Iraq, all these national disasters, all this instability. But what they don't turn around and tell us is the profiteers come in, the carpetbaggers. They used to call them in the post-Civil War era, the people who come in to clean up. And not in terms of to clean away debris and to help people to clean up from the new economic opportunities created from catastrophe. And we all know about ambulance chases. You have a horrible accident and your family's laying out on the expressway bleeding to death, and some shady shyster lawyer shows up for a meal ticket. He's not there to bring you justice. He sees an opportunity. Dollar sign. And if he finds out that the person who ran you down didn't have insurance, there was really no opportunity to sue and for a payday, he'll leave you there, bleeding out. But the entire economy, it's not just ambulance chasers. There's storm chasers. There's natural disasters chasers. There's dysfunctional, oppressed community chasers. People that show up and profit from all of this dysfunction. So those people, if you try to work and organize towards real peace, those people will come for you. And they will come violently for you. So again, you're just not stopping violence, you're deflecting it. If you try option number two, instead of organizing for real peace, and you go for pacification. So what if we don't have decent schools? So what if we don't have adequate, nutritious food? So what if we don't have our full civil and human rights? So what if we don't have economic opportunity? So what if we don't have basic vision, agendas, purpose, a movement to help us overcome our day-to-day challenges? So what? Despite all of that, stop the killing. At least you're alive. You know, it's better to starve righteously than to try to make a living through violence and through corruption. Right? So that's pacification. So if every black person put down the gun tomorrow, what would we have? We'd still have mass incarceration because the majority of people in prison are there for nonviolent crimes. Right? We'd still have over $1 trillion. At this point, the numbers crunchers and the lawyers have determined that the United States has stolen over $14 trillion worth of wealth from the black community. And again, this wealth wasn't just stolen through chattel slavery. There have been public and private agendas and policies to deny or to rob people of wealth. And the new international markets basically states obstructing people from earning a living is the same as robbing them. Because now if you interfere with corporate profits, if you interfere with corporations' opportunities to generate profit, then they can sue you in an international court because obstruction, and we got countless instances today and yesterday, not 100 years ago, of where the private and public interests have conspired to deny the black populace opportunities to create wealth, to generate income. So if the entire black community was a multinational corporation, we could go to the World Bank, IMF, NAFTA, GATT, these other international trade bodies and economic bodies and bring suits against the United States for unfair economic practices. So if you go the pacification route and say, despite all of that, despite being stripped of over trillions of dollars worth, incalculable, unimaginable amount of wealth, and they tell us to work harder from a deficit, you know, and to further entrench ourselves in a very system that there's absolutely no hopes. Even liberal economists are saying, if all things stay the same, it could take black folks over two centuries to come to economic parity with whites. And that's two centuries to catch up with the dysfunctional economic system. Because even among whites, the wealth is not distributed equally. There's high rates, relatively high rates for a Western nation of poverty. You know, white folks are also struggling to going bankrupt when they get a chronic disease. They're struggling with two income, overwhelming amount of debt. So even though they have so much, it's just that black folks are in such a pitiful state economically in this nation that whites, and they're pretty much in a gilded state, high levels of income inequality. But to catch up to their dysfunctional economic state, it could take us almost two centuries. And if you tell black people, given all of that, still just don't engage in violence, put down the gun, and remain oppressed, because there's no I don't see amongst the people saying put down the gun, they don't really, I don't see in a revolutionary agenda an anti-establishment radical agenda for changing all of that. And putting down the gun will not stop, because there was a time when we didn't have the guns in our hands, and white aggression, racism was still prominent and still aggressive. Racism didn't start when we started forming black gangs. Racism didn't start when the crack epidemic, which racism brought and descended and perpetuated through our community. So racism would still be here. So even if we did not engage, but, you know, cause and effect, one doesn't really directly affect the other. So if you want to pacify the people, at least you can get funding. Kellogg Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates, people. I see a lot of black organizations, religious and secular, getting a lot of money to promote pacification in the hood. So peace, that's a little harder. Nobody's going to fund you to create real peace and justice. And you got no justice, but you want peace. That's called pacification. You can get funding. You can set up a foundation, community development corporations, and all these multinational corporations, all of these organizations will throw money at you. Or you could do the revolutionary route and redirect the violence, saying the violence is justified, the violence is understandable, the violence is even predictable, because no matter where you are, no matter the culture, no matter the race, no matter the era and time, when you have, you know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. When you impose dehumanizing conditions on people, people behave in an inhumane way. So you're only going to say who is going to catch it. Will the oppressed man who goes to work and is dehumanized and his white co-workers rub on his head for fun and kick him in the butt, and when it's time to show up to get the check, he knows he's only getting a fraction of what white folks got, even though he does more work. So is he going to go to the crap house and stab somebody? Is he going to go home and beat his wife to death? Or is he going to go to the bar and drink himself to death? He's going to do violence. He's going to, as his life is not allowed to develop, he's going to want to diminish someone else's life. So you can lash out at your peers. You can lash out at your significant others. Or you can lash out internally and engage in self-annihilation. You say, we don't commit suicide, we kill ourselves. There's a big difference. Bobby Wright wrote a very insightful article on that in his book, The Psychopathic Racial Personality, the second chapter, the essay on black suicide and how it's not really suicide. There's a difference between, but again, we'll back out that rabbit hole and hopefully revisit it later. But in a revolutionary sense, you say, well, I'm going to go after the boss. Not only am I not going to go after the boss, I'm going to go after the very institutional infrastructure, system, and culture that allowed the boss to be the boss. You can lash out that way. And that's the most productive way to lash out, because you're going to do violence. So violence begets violence, violence in, violence out. So those are the solutions. Again, my community, I see the most popular solution being, you know, I prefer a working towards actual peace with a revolutionary option in parallel development to be enacted at any given point in preparation for the retaliation of the status quo. Because again, peace threatens profits. And anything that threatens profits will have both the private and the public sector drop on you like a ton of bricks. But anyway, that's my summation of the violence. I don't think there's an overnight solution to the violence, even though people want immediate solutions to the violence. But tomorrow, today, right now, you can begin to work to address the violence as I'm speaking to you. But again, as I so often am reminded by Dr. Claude Anderson, it took us over two centuries to get here. It might take us another two centuries to get out of here if we start working today. So you're either moving deeper into the system or you're moving out of it. And right now, or you're stagnating and just allowing everything to move around you. But I really would like to start to advocate for peace. Start to organize and to build peace, as opposed to there's just so much. And I get a lot of people reaching out to me and they want me to come in and help them and work with them, especially on Chicago's violence right in my community where I live on the south side of Chicago. But I can't really bring myself to it because I can't front. Like, everything I talk about, I've been there for the most part. I've been a black Puritan. I've never quite elevated to the status of a toxic black nationalist. It's just not my disposition. But I've been a black Puritan, even when I left the church and began to dismantle my ideological indoctrination. I made the same flaw of trying to Africanize my Western patriarchal indoctrination. If I take all of this nonsense that's been poured into me, that's been enculturated into me, and drape it in mud and kente cloth, then it's African. So it's not an easy thing to do, to deconstruct and rebuild your very identity. So I've been there, and I've been a liberal advocating for pacifications of my community. I worked with groups like the Block Brothers, Boys and Girls Club, Kellogg Foundation, the Stop the Violence Coalition, all of that. And then as I just continue to learn, continue to study, continue to work for justice, I was like, I'm not bringing about peace. In fact, I'm being funded by some of the biggest organizations that profit from and provoke warfare and oppression in order to pacify my own community. And a lot of brothers I talk to in the streets, when I was in the prison, when I was in Correction Corps of America in Lawrence, Kansas, I had opportunities to go into the jails to talk to young brothers and sisters. A lot of women in prison as well. And they looked at me like, you don't understand. And I didn't. But thankfully, I did listen to the perpetrators of violence, to the victims of violence. And I worked for sometimes in a trauma center. And I would deal with people just as, you know, recent shooting, recent stabbing victims. And really understanding, having a very intimate relation, and not to mention the enormous, relentless violence that was in my own life, growing up black and poor in the United States, that in itself, you know, you're going to be subjected to some violence, lateral violence, descending violence, and even from time to time, ascending violence. I have to review the archives. If you go to the archives, I think we broke that down, or maybe not. We'll really talk about violence, because I don't think we really have a real understanding in violence. I've had so many people sitting across from me talking about they want peace, they want to stop the violence, and I look at them and their whole body, literally from the tip of their head down to the bottom of their feet, they're draped in violence. And when I point this out to them, I'm like, you have an iPhone. Do you know how much bloodshed it took to bring you that iPhone? You drove here in a car. You know how much bloodshed it took not only to manufacture that car, but to secure the fuel for that car? Where's your shirt made? Bangladesh? Where are your pants made? Honduras? Where are your shoes made? Haiti? Dominican Republic? China? I said, you are there, and violence helps to sustain you in every aspect of your life. The land you live on, whether you rent or buy, was taken through bloodshed and violence, genocide, and sustained through slavery. Every dollar in your pocket, every dollar in your pocket has the image of a racist, colonist, genocidal, enslaver, or racist. And even if you don't carry a cashless society, that plastic you have, the major credit card companies are heavily vested with with both the prison industrial complex and the military industrial complex. Raytheon, Halliburton, Bechtel, all of these huge multinational conglomerates that go across, blowing stuff up across the world and then taxing the very people they just blew up to rebuild their stuff so they can come blow it up in another decade or so. So I'm saying, you're sitting in front of me completely draped in violence. Your whole, all of your comfort and your entire lifestyle is sustained by violence. And you want to get out of this meeting early so you can go home and watch football, you know. But you're telling me you want to tell other people how not to engage in violence. Why don't you stop the violence that you profit from before you go and tell the next dude to stop the violence he profits from? I mean, there are literally people, I've gone to anti-violence gatherings or events, and there's like recruitment tables for the U.S. military. You know, huh? You know, I'm about to start sounding like Dick Gregory. What's this game about? Huh? You know, shout out to the elder Dick Gregory. Because, I mean, it's maddening to me. So, and I, like I said, in my teens and in my 20s, I was part of all that mess too. And if I could grow and come to realize the error of my ways. But again, you have a lot of people who've invested a lot of time, people who have been tear gassed, who have been locked up for trespassing, who have been, you know, roughed up by cops, have been through that, you know, protest. Fortunately, I've always escaped any type of hard charges, you know. They always knock your stuff down to, like, when you're protesting, they'll try to scare you. Oh, you're getting a felony, assault, resisting arrest, and they'll knock it down to trespassing or failure to comply. So, but people invest a lot of times in their so-called peace that is actually pacification. They invest a lot of their selves into that, and it's hard to walk away from it. But again, you have to deconstruct everything, all your ideas, dissect them, lay them out naked before you, and then re-put them back together, because you have the good components. You don't want black folks dying needlessly. You don't want us committing violence. You don't want premature loss of life. You don't want massive amounts of, because for every individual that dies from a bullet wound, there are dozens who are crippled for life or injured for life. And for every, all those dozens, there are literally hundreds of our people who are psychologically wounded by that violence. So I understand. I mean, let's stop it today. But we can't do the knee-jerk thing. We're ancient people, so we should have a different understanding and relationship with time. Oh, I don't know if I mentioned this yet, but we're going to be wrapping up the show at 7 a.m. because I had an unresolvable conflict in my schedule, which this is a one-time thing. I'm apologizing, and hopefully I don't get fired, but that's the thing. And I just learned about that this morning. So everything's got to be compressed, and I'm indulging myself going on and on about this issue of violence. But I think it's something we need to understand, because it's kind of hard for me to criticize people out here doing pacification work, because most of them are truly sincere in their work. And I've been one of those people. And you get bumps in the head. You have to inhale tear gas. You even have to get your own people. You know, I've been ran up out of places. I've been swung on. I've been jumped by dudes trying to do violence intervention. And then they redirect their violence at you. But what I should have been doing is working to revolutionize the people. Not condemning their violence, but telling them you just need to redirect your violence. You need to identify the real enemy and target that enemy. That's scary talk. That's crazy talk. Unless you're in the military. We encourage people, you know. But anyway, let's go, because I wanted to talk about labor. That's when I came here Monday and I was locked out. I wanted to talk about labor. Actually, I want to talk about labor, class, and caste. So let's do a short musical interlude, and then I guess we're going to wrap up with labor, class, and caste. 312-985-7834. It's an attenuated show, a shortened show, but an episode. But I'm here. And I'm ready to do this for as long as I'm able to do this. And I would like for you to join me. Thanks for listening. This is Brother Diallo Show, Q4 Radio, AM 1680.
I am an H2 worker. Coming from the island of Jamaica. I am a H2 worker, cutting cane in a Florida, working so hard in the burning sun, wondering if slavery really done. I'm working, working, working on your cane field still, working, working, working for your mega dollar bill. So don't bite the hands that feed you. I have dreams like you too. Don't treat me like I'm a slave here. Just give me a wage, that is fear. I'm working, working, working on your cane field still. Working, working, working for your mega dollar bill. I am a H2 worker, picking apple in a Florida. I am a H2 worker, hoping that things will be better. So don't take me for granted and pass me like it's only a cane and apple, you see. Don't take it for joke and run me, then send to the government for more. Are we? It's not slavery, just poverty, talking to democracy. Better you did send me to war, then I would have seen what I'm fighting for. Just the needy, talking to the greedy, just the goodness of the restless, wanting to make a better life for my children and wife. I'm working, working, working on your cane field still. Working, working, working for your mega dollar bill. Come to your land to help you, to help me, to help you. This is not slavery, just poverty wanting democracy. So don't bite the hands that feed you. I have dreams like you too. Don't take my situation for weakness. Don't even think that I am helpless. I'm getting restless. Working on your cane field still. I'm working. Working, working on your cane field still. Working, working, working for your mega dollar bill. I'm working, working, working on your cane field still. I'm working, working, working for your mega dollar bill. Working, working, working on your cane field still. Working, 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 working for your mega dollar bill. I'm working.
H2 worker. Muta Baruka. Man, you know, my wife revealed to me, I think in our 10th year of marriage, that she was not the biggest fan of Muda Baruka. So I'm saying, brothers, before you make that commitment, before you walk down that aisle or watch her walk towards you in that aisle, get to know your wife. Get to know your woman. Peruse her MP3 player at this stage. In my stage, it would have been peruse her CD collection. But scroll through her digital devices. Because that just, I mean, we're still struggling. We're in counseling. We're getting help. Working through this. You know, I'm sure one day, if we stay at it, she will understand that Muda Baruka is one of the, is the greatest dub poet, alive or dead. Anyway, H2 worker. I came here Labor Day. The place was locked up. I didn't know how to get in. I guess the Brother Diallo show will be on a holiday schedule because they don't trust me with keys to the joint. I got the codes, but I don't have the main keys. So I can get through some doors, but not all doors. But I'm sure if I work hard, I will elevate and one day have the keys to the kingdom. But right now, I'm just a lowly show host. So when the main doors are locked, I can't do the show. And they locked this place down for holidays. So I guess I will put a holiday schedule on because I didn't know that. Because you know me, I'm so black. I'm so militant. These holidays don't mean nothing to me. But actually, let's talk about Labor Day. What did y'all do for Labor Day? Barbecued? Would you talk Black Nationalist? Y'all don't celebrate these Western holidays, regardless of the significance. See, here's my issue with Labor Day. It's a watered-down May Day. It's a watered-down International of the Workers of the World Day. Labor Day in the United States came one year after the Haymarket Massacre, which founded May Day, which was a radical labor uprising. May Day, or Internationals of Workers of the World, came from a group called the Wobblies. And the historian Howard Zinn does a lot of really good and interesting write-up because I don't understand why labor history is not more prominent in the United States. I totally understand that. But I understand why the elites don't want us to know labor history. They want us to think that the United States, when it was founded, was a middle-class society. It was a free society where all participants were able to participate. But in reality, the American democracy is like everything else under capitalism. It was a commodity to be bought, sold, and traded to the highest bidder. Even in its foundings, the United States had established what they call a Greek-style democracy, as opposed to what some might call a primitive democracy you might find amongst the Bedouins in the Middle East, pre-Islamic Bedouins, amongst the Twa people of Central African plains, amongst the many of the native tribes of the Caribbeans, the Tainos. That was true democracy, but the Europeans would call that primitive democracy. That was truly the one man, one woman, one vote. But the Greek democracy was not like that. There were a whole, and it wasn't truly a democracy, but hey, the dominant people with the guns say it's democracy, so okay, put your hands up where they can see you and say, okay, you call that a democracy. They say that the Greeks founded democracy, even though the majority of people, because as we understand in our very limited understanding and very limited education in the West, democracy means majority rules. And I'm going to tie this back into labor. But a democracy means majority rules. So if you have a society, and first of all, I guess it goes without saying, only the human inhabitants are able to engage the democracy. The animals don't have a vote. Nature doesn't, which I think it should. I think all living things in the ecosystem should be brought in forward and have equal weight within societal decisions. And we better figure that out quick or the world will not be able to sustain any life, starting with human life. But again, let's not go down that rabbit hole. Basically, Greek democracy were wealthy white men of status. Slaves couldn't vote, didn't have a say. Women didn't have a say. The imperial subjects, who maybe weren't enslaved but weren't full citizens of the empire, didn't have a say. And those people made up the majority. So, but these people say this is demos, means people. It's Greek for people, or maybe it's Latin for people. I don't know, Latin, Greek, whatever, for people. So demos means rule of the people, governance of the people, power to the people, which Greek didn't have. But, I mean, what do we know? We came off the plantation when they legalized us being able to read after being illegal. If it's illegal for your people to read for 200 years, then you're not going to come off the plantation and say, well, let's write some books. So the only thing we could read is what they had available to us. And the books they gave us says Africans had no history. Europeans founded democracy. And then after a few brothers read through a few books and got a little education, they went around the world and like, wait a second. There are societies, civilizations, cultures older than the Greeks that predate the Greeks. In fact, societies that the Greeks on the hardcore archaeological records say that the Greeks actually got everything they got from the inferior people. So when all that got discovered and dug up, they had to say, well, we can't say that we didn't found democracy. We've been lying saying Europeans founded democracy. So now we'll have different types of democracy. We'll just classify it differently. That way we can still say our democracy was the first democracy of the democracy that it is. I know it's confusing, but this is this is higher learning, y'all. So that's what it's all about. You know you're engaged in higher levels of education and learning and analysis when you get confused. If you're clear on things, then you're primitive. You don't know what you're talking about. Clarity means stupidity in this context. But I know it's confusing. Don't blame me. I'm only telling y'all what I was taught, you know. And I graduated with honors, so you know I know. Anyway, it's like Bill Cosby said, we're intellectuals, therefore we have to take classes to figure out what other people know naturally. So anyway, the democracy... Oh, I got to watch time. I only got 15. Lord have his mercy. How can I rush this? I'm going to have to revisit this and take a chunk out of the Friday extended show. So we'll see how far we get with this and see whether or not we even want to revisit this. If I'm boring you with this, but I think it's important. But anyway, they say, okay, since we have to acknowledge because we let the blacks, we legalize black learning. We legalize black learning and they had not yet implemented their technology of control to say, well, even though it's legal for black folks to learn, let's create an indoctrination system, a mass indoctrination system that will have us reject learning. But anyway, that's a whole nother discussion. So they started calling it primitive democracy. But Greek democracy is the American democracy. It's the democracy where you got to have, you got to pay to play. The more power you have, the more. So initially it was raw. It was like, yo. Landed gentry, white male with land, which means wealth, investment capital, means you can vote. If you don't have wealth, I don't care. You could be blonde hair, blue eyed, Aryan, white dude. You still couldn't vote. Irishmen couldn't vote. So this wasn't a democracy because the majority of the people who resided in the land under the Constitution were not allowed to vote. But they still said it was a democracy. In fact, they still go around the world saying that the United States is the oldest democracy. But again, power is the ability to define something and then have it act in the desired manner, as Huey P. Newton articulated to us. So they have the power to say this is democracy, even though we know the very definition of democracy contradicts what the elites call democracy. We still have to say we live in a democratic society. And then when with various movements, people dying and fighting and struggling and being incarcerated and hung and exiled to get the very rights guaranteed to them in the Constitution, all of a sudden you had what they call a pure democracy, a popular democracy. There's still some ageism there because you have to be 18 to vote, even though you don't have to be 18 for the policies that people vote on to impact you. And there's really no real cognitive reason why an 18-year-old is more worthy to vote than, let's say, a 16-year-old. Heck, I'd knock the vote down to 10-year-olds. But anyway, that's me and my anarcho vegan dictatorship with democratic elements. If I ruled the world. But so the United States finally came to a pure democracy. But then that can't happen because the founders of the nations and those who inherited the nations from them, those who accepted the nation from them, understood that the masses have what the, in the olden days they called leveling impulses, meaning that they wanted their fair share of stuff. But they didn't want to say, well, they wanted to take back what was theirs. So they would say, well, the masses, the voters, the unwashed masses have leveling impulses, meaning they want to make things level. Or as Kwame Ture called it, an instinctive drive towards justice. We have an inherent instinctive understanding of fairness. Whether we engage that, or we try to promote it, or we try to expand unfairness is here nor there. But instinctively, Bill Gates loves to go around the world saying life isn't fair, get used to it. But he's the same dude that spends millions of dollars suing people and locking people up for pirating his software. So he hasn't gotten used to unfairness. He's going to secure his fairness with his billions of dollars, which isn't fair. But again, so if you take a monkey, you take a dog, you take an infant and put them in a way where they can be exposed to injustice, they will recognize it immediately. So we can create fair societies. You put an 8-year-old, you put my 8-year-old son in charge of the U.S. economy because he's obsessed with fairness. His brother's not going to get nothing that he don't get a cut of. He wants his cut. He will have his bond, his pound of flesh. So he understands, no, this is how he's going to redistribute the whole monopoly board. So we understand what fairness is. We understand democracy. We have the capacity, but the elites can't afford democracy. Capitalism cannot have democracy because democracy will lead to peace, and peace diminishes profit. So they've created economics. So they decided, since we can't own the vote, because it used to be, well, I am a wealthy landed gentry. I am a white male with wealth and status. Therefore, I can vote. Now, everybody gets to vote. The Irishman who just got here, escaping potato famine. The Italian who came here, fleeing fascism. The Ukrainian who came here fleeing nuclear fallout. The African who came up north fleeing white aggression. All these unworthy, unwashed people who are now able to vote. And I couldn't sustain the facade of freedom and democracy and still maintain. So, you know, PR, window dressing, makeup on a pig. So what did they do? Since they can't own the vote, they decided, let's own the politicians. So we all get to vote for the politicians that they own. Which is slick. I mean, you got to give the elites their props. I mean, you got to respect a 1% that can rule over a 99% and have everybody in check and have us beating each other to death over food stamps and shaming each other and complaining and running up on each other in Walmart over food stamps while they go and spend $1.5 billion on a defunct weapon system that the Pentagon swears up and down it has no use for. Pimp hand is strong. I mean, I'm impressed. Can you have utter disdain and hatred for something you also have absolute respect for? Because that's where I am. Like, wow, kudos to you, you devils. Anyway, so where does that leave labor? What does that have to do with labor and caste and all that? Well, you have to understand the origins of American democracy to understand the origins of America's power distribution, to understand the origins of American labor, class, and caste systems and how they have evolved and how we are under the illusion that the United States, being the land of the free, home of the brave, the land of the thief, home of the slave, can be the both. At the same time, the home of the radical labor movement gave birth to the global radical labor movement, and at the same time is one of the biggest subverters of labor empowerment. Because in the Western context, again, you're defined by, you're valued by your work. That's not the, you know, some cultures have inherent value. Like, I'm alive, I'm here, I'm breathing, I exist. And it's like, well, you have value. In the Western context, like, well, what do? You meet a young lady you're interested in. I mean, within the first conversation, so what do? You know, so you got to do something. It's like, well, I eat, I consume, I inhale oxygen, I exhale carbon. You know, I just exist. Then you're worthless. There's no inherent value, which is a sick culture, which is the culture that leads to omnicide. Because a tree is nothing until you make it into a table. That cow has no inherent value until you chop it up into steaks. And so when they went to other cultures and found that people, wow, these people worship trees. They worship cattle. They worship the sun and the water. They're crazy. They're primitive. They're devils. They're wicked. And it wasn't that the primitive, the indigenous people of the world worshiped these things. But for the Western colonizers, reverence equaled worship. Like, we long polluted our streams. Western Europe used to be completely covered in forest. There used to be large predators, cave bears, and large cats, and dire wolves, and a massive ecosystem. But the European culture, the European mindset, the Western Neanderthal mindset was like, yo, how can I turn this thing that exists that has no inherent value into something of value? So how does the wolf become valuable? When I turn it into a pelt. How does the forest become valuable? When I cut it, burn it, and turn it into to charcoal, to smelt iron, to build swords. Value. So the Western mentality is that, number one, man has dominion over the earth, and that and don't say, hey, this is just an angry, impoverished black man saying this. These are Western philosophers. Freud, Marx, Karl Marx is the main one. I mean, I got this from y'all, white folks, listening. Again, I'm just articulating what I learned from y'all and what I've observed also. And maybe I'm putting my own slant, my own little soul and groove into it, but this is on y'all. And again, we're going to see this. I had planned this for the whole 2-hour show, but then I went into violence, and which would have caught me up. And I keep looking at the clock, but I guess I have to look at the clock. It's unprofessional. I miss a lot of my breaks and anything. This is Q4 Radio AM 1160, broadcasting from Genesis Art Supply on the north side of Chicago, which is south side, that bony homie from the south side. I'm supposed to say bony homie from Stony, but I don't live in Stony. Bronzeville. I have to find a way to rhyme Bronzeville. It's like a catchy phrase. Maybe I can contact Common, since that's where I got Boney Honey from Stony from, and he'll put something together for me. Anyway, man, I want to get into this, but basically, I don't know how to condense this, because I don't know. Maybe I'm not giving my listeners enough credit. I think sometimes I feel obligated to give all this context and backstory, but maybe I could just get to the point, but then we wouldn't have a show. If I just got to the point and say, hey, black people, because the ultimate point that I'm getting to is, number one, Labor Day is a watered down version of May Day. Labor needs to be radicalized. The point of labor, of organized labor, of unionized labor, of conscious labor, is not to secure work security. It's not an effort to secure higher wages or job security. The point of organized labor, based on its origins and its relationship to the elites, the oligarchs, is to secure the means of production, to render or wrest control of the means of production from the oligarchs, from the investor class, from the inheritors of wealth. The builders and creators of wealth should be the true owners of wealth, not the inheritors of wealth, like Trump's kids. Or Bill and Melinda Gates' kids. I can't just say Trump and Melania, because Trump got 3 baby mamas. But we don't call him baby mamas because he's rich and white. We call him his ex-wives, whatever. And so that is what class, and that's labor. As far as class, Europeans in the United States are the most ignorant of class. We don't even know, and I think we need to get back to class analysis and classifications. And I know in the modern context, in the social media era, everybody's so hip and evolved that they don't like labels. And I wish people that talk this nonsense about how they don't like labels were forced to shop at grocery stores that had everything in the exact same containers with no labels on the outside. Flour, salt, sugar, peanuts. Everything is just a box you can't see through, so you can't judge it by its looks, and it has no writing on the outside. And that's where you have to buy all of your food if you're against labels, because you're so enlightened. Me, I love me some labels. And when something lacks a label, I work to understand it so that I can classify and label it and partition it. Not to isolate it, but understand its relationship to all things. Because I'm a synthetical thinker. I think you can only understand things or phenomenon or people if you tie it to all other things. Whereas in the Western scientific methods, which I was trained in, you know, I took radium physics, chemistry, all that stuff, human anatomy, physiology, where they try to isolate everything. When I was studying the human body, they take the skeletal system and break that apart. And then they take the bone and then break that into its fundamental components. And everything's broken down. And they never really get to getting back to, like, tying everything back together again. So you're really educated if you understand things in its most minute, isolated components. And that's why intellectuals are often so ineffective or of so little use to us. Because they get to the point where they can only see their little minute, like I am a psychologist, or I'm a physicist, or I'm a brain surgeon, like, what's this, that guy that ran for president? Gifted Hands, Ben Carson. Dude knows everything about brain surgery and next to nothing about nothing else. It's incredible. So that's what happens with intellectualism. So you have to, as you get your formal education, then you have to repair your thinking processes and your understanding, your methodologies. But, oh, it's 8 o'clock. I'm so sorry, y'all. I got to wrap this gavel up. B, turn on the wrap it up box. I'm going to close out the show early today and go back to some... again, we'll revisit this. I'm making a note in the Brother Diallo journal. Labor class cast. I'll see y'all Friday with the extended show. Thanks for listening. And again, I'm sorry for this early conclusion. This is a one-time conflict in my schedule that I wasn't able to resolve. See y'all in 2 days. Peace. Hotep. Alucio Continuum.